This is Robert Stark. I'm here with Pill Eater, and we're going to be discussing his latest novel, Almond Eyes, Baby Face. And we're also going to talk about his science fiction erotic story, The Rape of McCall, which he just added into his new edition for Trip, which we already did a show about. Pill Eater, great talking to you.
It's so nice talking to you, Robert, and I'm very excited to talk about a very important work of mine that represents me in my teenage years and early 20s, so this is going to be a special show.
Well, Almond Eyes, Baby Face is a series of short stories, but one of the main ones, would you say, is the first major story is a semi-autobiographical?
It pretty much is an autobiographical work of art. I mean, Almond Eyes, Baby Face was simply a poetic term to describe the very first chapter of the book, talking about my sexy girlfriend that I like, who had nice blue striped panties, and I loved hanging out at her dorm room and having sex for the first time in my entire life. And it's really hard to come to write that in words. And so, you know, just hanging out with your girlfriends and just being in that zone, you know, I compare at that same time I was seeing this movie, Shin Godzilla, which was in the theaters at the time. And so I wrote about it, and I kind of made my witty observations upon it. And I basically was throwing all these words from things. And so what the main point of it is, yeah, it's a snapshot of where I was. And that first story that opens up is just a lot of stuff is dropped, and even funnier parts just about my own life, because for one thing, if you want to know something about me, I live kind of in and outside of Philadelphia. And if you know something about Philadelphia, it is the most far east Midwest city. It's not New York City. It's kind of like a quaint Midwest city, kind of like Cincinnati, but it's near New York. So it's far east with a Midwest flair. And there's these disgusting foods called cheesesteaks, and a lot of black people, and a lot of crime, and just like poverty. And it's not a fun sweppel place to be. You gotta kind of be in your own zone. So there is this upper class part of Philadelphia outside, you know, like Penn, you know, Penn is there, UPenn, but you know, there's these gated
communities. Are you talking about the suburbs or the within the downtown area?
Suburbs and UPenn. It seems to be a very J.D. Salinger waspian kind of place, you know. Some well-known people are there, and it kind of is I do believe Trump's family has a place near the colleges of Villanova and near Drexel. And so, yes, I could be talking about my Wes Anderson you know, upper class part of that all, but I think I want to really talk about Philly and how mundane it is, and how living out that existence and a boring suburb life is so boring. You know, most of these people say how great their youth is, but to me, Almond Eyes, Baby Face is really about myself and about how psychotic I can really become or focused on a certain object. And especially being very personable about music I like and art I like and things, and just being open about myself. And on the very first chapter, you know, I'm also talking about a very old creative writing piece I really enjoyed called Nana Song, and it is autobiographical.
Is that the one based on Leon the Professional with Natalie Portman?
Yeah, because there's a character in there which is based upon Natalie Portman's figure, because I really love that film, but I also love Slam Dunk, which is one of my favorite animes I used to watch when I was 21 and lonely in my room, and I had, you know, cried myself to sleep and just make my room dark and just watch 100 episodes of Slam Dunk. And I loved Mahjong so much because I had a girlfriend who I dedicate this book to, that I would just play Mahjong with her family. And it came from the heart, Nana Song. It's a very Dom DeLillo postmodern piece. I don't know about the DeLillo part, but certainly cut up and interesting and science fiction-like.
My impression of Nana Song was that it's it's very short and kind of surreal and poetic. And there's these different characters I mean, one of them is based on the Natalie Portman character, but I think there's also a Japanese character and then a black character. Can you explain the different characters, and is there some kind of plot to it?
Well, the black kid, have you ever seen a Harmony Korine film called Gummo? There's that little black midget with the Israeli sign, you know, Korine plays with your vision and stuff like that. So I made a cameo appearance in there, and the robots, and I look at it as like experimental film, really, this prose. And there's this one book I really used to like by Luigi. It's in my library right now, but I'm thinking it right now. And Six Characters in Search of an Exit. Very surreal. Or Six Characters in Search of an Author.
Do you have a published copy of a Nana song on your blog?
Yes, on my Minio Maya blog. I even have the original paper stuff and all the criticisms by the normies, and they called me crazy and strange and whatever. And it's not that bad. It's just anti-normie. And I was just being expressive of myself. Hey, I think I would go back to that science fiction medium. I was very young at the time, and it was my favorite piece ever. And so, ironically, this is a meta piece. That was really written for a creative writing class when I was 21, and
what was the reaction of the class from the teacher and the other students?
They thought I probably wanted to shoot up the school or something, or they thought I was a weirdo, and I had to tell them, well, I liked Netrunner CGI art, I love Francis Bacon, I love surrealist film, and what I'm doing is I'm making science fiction. I didn't write it about any lesbian prose or about social justice. I thought I was doing something special and unique that came from my heart. And so I joke about that because really, Nana Song is one real piece in a poetic piece about my girlfriend looking upon it and saying, oh, what are you doing, Pilleter? And he's all like, well, I'm doing my homework. But actually, it's... I don't know if my girlfriend ever did get that piece, but because...
Did you have a crush on the character and Leon the Professional when you were younger?
You know, that's a good question, but, I don't know about Natalie Portman. I thought she was, I don't want to say sexy, but very cool and slick. And, I thought, you know, I could make a character like that. I think I love Natalie Portman's character. I love her very, punk-like attitude. And, it's not like I'm in love with her or anything. I would say a character I'd be in love with, of course, I told you this before, Roaming Millennial.
Oh, Amazing Pan Adventure.
Amazing Pan Adventure, or any Roaming Millennial as a doll, I'll fall in love with her. My heart throbs for her. But
And then the film The Crush, of course.
Well, the film we could be talking for, you know. But it's really, the first part of the book is just really autobiographical stuff about me. But it's also... cut and paste activities of stuff I did when I was younger. Immediately after the first piece, the reader is going to be introduced from a sex omegle chat of, I'll give it away, of pretty much me acting like a girl because I've always had fantasies about, you know, like guys fucking me. And I always thought it would be cool if only I was a girl.
Oh, yeah, that actually is a little bit confusing to the reader because it comes out of the blue. And the main character is a male, and then the genders are switching. So you eventually figure it out, but at first it's a little bit confusing. This is the actual transcript of that chat you had?
Yes, and kind of getting high, because I wanted to be a Asian girl, and I wanted to, and sometimes I'll do this on Omegle, and I will go and pretend to be the guy's favorite Asian girl, and guys love it. And, you know, it sounds really like trap mentality, but that's why people turn into these men's dress up as kind of these cosplay gays. That's fun to do, and it's playful, and it's just I would like, you know, sometimes of just trying too much getting the girl. Sometimes I just want to be the girl and
was
be the guy's
just
dream.
For the attention, or did you get off erotically?
I kind of got off erotically through it, but I just thought I would share it because I guess some people do that. And some people like that, and I thought it would be very interesting for the reader of just reading, you know, transcripts of what I'm talking about. But that piece lasted, I think, for an hour and a half, just talking to this guy. But they always ask for your kick at the end of the chat, so I don't know what a kick is. And Meagle is a very strange culture, I will say that. And the Almond Eyes Baby Haze has a lot to do with internet culture. And I think if you understand internet culture or the new alt-lit kind of Sam Pink style of writing, the kind of biography or certain types of literature where you the espatorial novel, or, you know, the I can't remember what it's called, but the novel written as a series of documents, espatorial, I can't even say it, but that's kind of what I do. It's a series of documents, Almond Eyes Baby Face, and I put it together like that. You know, right after the Omegle chat, I'll be talking about myself and just going depression, like some suicidal emo note. I think that comes
from
the heart.
Well, you do say something about the character being expelled from high school and then talking about wanting to like rape the popular blonde girls and like shoot up the place and then eventually getting expelled and transferred to a private school.
Well, some of it's true and some of it's not. Of course, I'm being very Dennis.
You exaggerate. It's based on your life experience.
Yeah.
You exaggerate stuff. Is it for the shock value or just to kind of amplify the experience of the trauma?
Amplifying, you know. It's not just shock. It's about, you know, myself. And, yeah, the normie will find it shocking because most don't. But I don't mean to be, I'm the bigger queer than thou. I don't mean to be a special snowflake. I tend to talk about trauma because I think everyone thinks about this stuff. And it's real art once you get it out there. And most people are cowards, don't want to talk about it. And it's true. Most people just make up their lives on the internet. Most people just, like, exaggerate. And they tell that they're this or they're that. The catfishing, right? And so it's really embarrassing when most of your youth is meaningless or not as some anime that you imagine, and you're living out in bumfuck Pennsylvania and you're not really getting anything accomplished. You're kind of suffering. And that's why anybody would be some retarded social justice warriors, because life's painful. But at the same time, this book is like Yukio Mishima's Confessions of a Mask. It really is. And this is my Confessions of a Mask book. Mishima written Confessions of a Mask when he was 24. I written this when that same age too. So I'm looking at it through that same lens, and a lot of it sticks with me, and a lot of it is my criticism towards how I see the world and how I see things. And I think of somebody else has to get out here and relate to me. And it's just like, it's kind of like I relate to you, he relates back to me. And it comes from the heart and it comes from the mind. And I'm not the only one thinking like this. This is kind of like a Philip K. Dick dialogue, kind of like in Valis.
You do go back to the themes in Eric Erickson's Psychosocialism. And one thing you talk about is the concept of, like, the college experience and how you felt that you failed at that.
Yeah, well, I never was the cool Chad that got to have sex, you know. And, well, really, I like to contradict myself all the time. I'm not a player. I don't drink beer. I don't smoke. I don't have promiscuous sex. I'm just a guy that wants to have a wife and three kids and a house and have a good-paying job, but that doesn't seem to go well. It seems like, rather, I'm a consumer being exploited by a merchant class, a Deleuzian merchant class, where it kind of is a strange, nothing goes right for me. And it's just, I think I'm not the only one who thinks that. I mean, dear God, if I lived in Arkansas and had to go to, like, some bumfuck school over there, good thing, grateful I've been to New York City and around, you know, Philly. Now, that's at least civilization, you know. Some people are fucked in Kansas, and and I feel like that is a theme, the psychosocial narrative, and we talked about this before an entire podcast, and about how narratives, that is the millennial war. And if you don't live by a narrative, you might as well be Elliot Rodgers and shoot up the place and kill yourself. But I'm not like that. I'm like Andy Nowicki. I overcame those wannabe wanker styles, and I'm still living. I'm just a Brian Aldiss once said, I'm adults are the dead corpse of children. Maybe you could call me a walking dead corpse of the past, okay, but I'm not that guilty. I think I'm an innocent person. I'm doing the right thing. Maybe you could call it Christian, but I'm not that cucked to be a cucked Christian. Like, I want to deny that, you know, because most Christians are be like, you know, they want to be Christians because they don't get any sex. No, I'm not some phony Christian like that. And I believe in the good, and I believe in authenticity. And with bad people, you just push them aside and you overcome that, right? I don't fall into that. I got huge willpower, and a lot of this is coming for that. But I do mention Erik Erikson a lot through this stuff, and there is a lot of esoteric wordplay in here that you.
Another interesting thing you said is about millennials is that they're kind of emulating the previous generations, like Generation X and their parents, the baby boomers. But you're saying that do you see millennials as failing to create a new subculture from scratch? Or you Absolutely. See, you do see that, but it's kind of coming from the kind of fringe avant-garde, like people like yourself
and you too, Robert. Everybody who has internet access and into their alt-right mentality, you see millennials.
But that's okay. I mean, yeah, it can be a complete okay. thing. It doesn't have to be for the masses.
You're right, and what's even really strange is that you're exact. The masses are basically, you know, 5 years ago. 5 years ago, there was no such. I never text. I never had a phone. I didn't know what texting was. I was that big of a geek. And all of a sudden, being in community college, and everyone starts texting. This was before Snapchat too. Everybody started texting. Everybody exchanged numbers. I'm like, really? I thought you called people. I just had some geeky, autistic friends I would play board games with. I never really texted people. And that and guess what's accomplished in 5 to 7 years with texting technology? We now have this manosphere men's right activist gaming going on with the whole Roosh V and the whole crazy, you know, when you date somebody you have to have a meta mind games, body signaling, abstractions of how to prove the relationship. It's just fucking crazy. Why can't you just ask a girl out and call her? You can't even call her now because you're a fucking creep if you do so. That's how crazy millennials are. You look up millennials and they define it through cute pictures of on your fucking glued to your fucking phone. I don't remember that at the turn. I was getting into digital hardcore and like that wasn't a thing. The texting was not a thing, and now this is, and within 5 to 7 years, it's kind of like being drafted to the war. Anything's going to be remember about millennials. You know, the silent generation was drafted to the great World War I, and they came back with PTSD and all that stuff. Well, millennials were drafted to the psychological warfare called the social media and getting your eyes stick into a computer so we became androids and cyber robots, and that's what's happened. It convoluted our minds and turned the normies into shit, and it's a cyberpunk warfare. William Gibson's right. That's basically what is happening now. Cyberpunk is real, and a lot of those prophecies are coming a reality, and now either we have to accommodate it or fight against the system, maybe creating a new Luddite party. I don't know, but is it the medium that rules over us? It's crazy, and so I think millennials are really fucked. You know, they're really fucked, and they're playing. We're at the apex right now. We're seeing the social justice warriors, the special snowflakes, girls that dye their hair blue because they think they're anime characters. It's pathetic. It's like we need millennials got to create their own philosophers now. We can't have this little dumbed down. And that's why we're paying so much to Gen X. Gen X is also important because it's parents right now. They're in the parents' positions. And I just don't know what's going to happen in 20 more years. And that makes me worried about what media the millennials are taking in, what they're learning, what they think is cool, what they think is. And that's a lot of questions I bring up in this book about my, you know, call me an anarchist, but I'm pretty much like that.
How much of your book is about Asian-Aryanism? And that's something that you advocate. And do you see that as a solution to these like psychosocial problems that you're talking about?
Yes, because ironically enough, Almanized Babyface is about my ideology, Asian-Aryanism. It's about this thing that I notice, you know, because people notice things. And having girlfriends who are Asian and having a better life, you know, a Depeche Mode stripped away from the sickness that is white girl feminism, right? And people are keeping it a secret. That, you know, Asian girls are a, you know, chance. And so, you know, there is a white Asian union. And I loved Asian studies. I went to Temple University for Asian studies. And I enjoyed my time there. I met very exotic people. But I was still this you know, kid enjoying myself and believing I was something greater than my bumfuckery back in suburbs, right? And so I think to myself that the Asian Aryan themes here, they come from anywhere from cut and paste style to internet comments. There's one part of the book where there's a rightstuff.biz article about why you shouldn't date Asian girls, and I thought, you know what's literature? If I just got the prose of these comments and just showed the world why are these comments, right?
What were their arguments and what were your rebuttals?
Well, here's some of them. Some of them include... So, I don't have any much rebuttals, but I wrote some of them. I wrote some things in italic, and some people from Laguna Beach Fogey to some Chinese guy to, and yeah, I'm gonna source them. I'm gonna quote them. They wrote a part of this book too. I'm citing them, and so I just thought it's better to read other people's comments about Asian girls from the right than it is to, you know, talk about it. This is an artistic cut up and paste thing, and we really look into the minds of these people. I mean, some of them will say, oh, Elliot Rodgers everywhere, and how bad is it? And then some people are like, I like that stuff. I really do, and that's amazing. And some people are like joking, and it's a really strange question that needs to be addressed. One of my favorite comments was by a guy named Dave6034. He wrote that that hybrids are messed up not because their parents are self-hating racists, but because their brains, like their faces, are like an incorrect mix-up of wife and Asian features. It's like having a race riot inside your head. In italics, I wrote, Atari Teenage Riot, anyone? I mean, hey, Nick Endo's Japanese, and you got German Jew, and so, like, that sounds a lot like Atari Teenage Riot to me. But, yeah, some people make these weird arguments found in such of the birth of Ryan Andrews, The Birth of Prudence, who we did a podcast with. Oh, yeah, that was the book
where you did a podcast for your channel with Ryan Andrews, and he falls in love with this Korean girl, and pretty much everything about her is perfect to him, but he ends up having to break up with her because he doesn't want to betray, like, Western civilization. Exactly. That's basically the premise of that book.
And somehow everyone on the right thinks that's some marvelous theme to go by. And it's like, what the fuck is Western civilization? That is so fucking frivolous. I mean, I broke up recently with my Korean SJW girlfriend, and like, okay, I get it. She was a little fucking crazy. But in this fictional prose that Ryan Andrews wrote, my only criticism is, like, it is dreamy, but you have this conveying message to white nationalists that somehow talking about... you know, dump a hot girl because it somehow doesn't match, like a circle and a square peg, or, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And so a lot of these people are LARPers, and the chances are probably most of them don't have access to Asian girls, or at least think of them as foreign. And even if they did have access, yeah, it's a special cause, but you shouldn't stop them because they're retarded. No, and, you know, it's a bell curvian thing. Charles Murray has an Asian wife. Bell curve, you know, the higher cognitive elite. I thought that was a good thing, but some people are very critical of that. And so my book often is awesome, like a race relations issue. I talk about race relations that you think any anti-racist would love to talk about. But, of course, you can't do that because anti-racists are part of this liberal school of thought. They will.
Well, it seems like they both sides hate you. The alt-right says that you're advocating the Kalergi plan, but on the other hand, that the anti-racists hate you because you're talking. So you're basically saying that identity is real, exactly. And we're all not just a bunch of, like.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the anti-racists are a bunch of white people who think they're hardcore punk anarchists, and that's so pathetic. You know, talk to them; they'll totally understand my view. As for the far right, well, they just prefer their own liberty. It's special if both the left and right hate you because you're really saying a powerful message that doesn't have answers yet. They don't want to answer this problem because it's not on their plate. They need to answer the smaller problems first. And one of them is the Jewish question. Everybody loves to talk about Jews. Jews in my sandwich, Jews in the sky. You know, people seem to... Kevin MacDonald has written it down in his book. And, you know, from Richard Spencer's speech at the Robert E. Lee Memorial, He says perpetual race war and the Jewish question. I guess that is the first thing that we're going to talk about. But sooner or later, we're going to come across the Asian question about what we do with whites and Asians. My answer is Asian Aryanism, and I come to that conclusion at the end of the book after a series of short stories, cut and paste, quotations. This is a book you can just pick up, go to any page, and start reading. It's in the classical style of like Peter Sotos or Hollister Kopp or Dennis Cooper is a great influence of mine. It's a fun and enjoyable piece. One of the biggest fans who've read my book is James Nulick, who wrote Valencia and Distemper. He's published on Nine Banded Books, and we got in contact just by talking about Andrea Tumine of his old school zine Optic Nerve, which is kind of like a mid-90s Asian Aryan zine, and we became good friends, Twitter friends, and he's actually a really good mentor to him, to me, and I find him so grateful to have a relationship with James Nulick. And James Nulick has some of the early copies of Almanized Babyface. So grateful to have his avocation on the back of the book, along with Andy Nowicki. Andy Nowicki says, well, Pill Eater sounds like a trippy name, but I haven't read the book yet, but it must be a good read. Well, I might as well cite Andy Nowicki as that as an avocation. But Nulick is the perfect avocation for my book, knowing that I know that this left-wing, right-wing paradigm seems to be just young millennial kids not knowing what they want, and we have to go
play. And you even quote Dylan Roof in the book.
Yes, on the Steve Peronko, Why Am I an Identitarian, which was actually submitted for ratings.
Oh, was that the article? That was an article that is actually, is that published on the Minio Maya fan club?
Yes, it was. And also given to Richard Spencer and Gregory Hood and all those Hannibal Bateman. They had this the contest 2 years ago. I was still in my early 20s, and basically what happened was they were looking for an identitarian thing, and I wrote that to them and made them shit their pants.
I mean, obviously it wasn't published, but did you get any responses?
Not really, but I'm pretty sure they were shocked. And what happened was this other guy by the name of Tim Smith, S-M-Y-T, who the fuck spells their name like that, wanted talking about how fucking gay he's on his Wes Anderson bicycle going to fucking Ireland. Some crazy-ass white nationalist shit. But look, the point of the matter is my piece should have been accepted because, hell, identitarianism is an art movement. And I know they're a bunch of fuddy-duddy conservatives. I'm pretty sure David Thrussell's right that Spencer probably is some kind of weird CIA agent. Sorry for starting petty drama. But, the point is these issues need to be addressed. And so I thought it was worthy enough to publish that Radix article in the Almanized Babyface. And Dylan Roof says in the opening, he even said this in his manifesto, quote, "I have great respect for the East Asian races. Even if we were to go extinct, they could carry on something. They are by nature very racist and could be great allies to the white race. I am not opposed at all to allies with the Northeast Asian races." And see, Dylan Roof right there has an Asian, he's Asian Aryan. Even Greg Johnson of Countercurrents writes, "If I had a son, he would look like Dylan Roof." He wrote that in a comment, that same Dylan Roof. I can archive it.
Oh, I know about that. That was kind of a parody where Barack Obama said, "If I had a son, he looked like Trayvon Martin." I remember that.
Exactly. And Johnson said that. It makes me think, well, is dead Greg Johnson an Asian Aryan? I even cite him later on as the relevance of old right. I think.
No, an Asian Aryan would say Elliot Rodger instead of Dylan Roof if he had to pick a free shooter.
I know, and I'm trying to make those connections, and Greg Johnson is also another huge influence upon my writing, and I see a lot of that very interesting white nationalist stuff going on, catering through my hardcore writings, you know.
Well, here's the thing about Asian Aryanism, is they're going to accuse you of advocating the destruction of the white race, but you've actually said in the past you view it as a backup plan.
Yeah, as one is a backup plan, and one is already a niche, but they just don't want to be they don't want to be open about it. Like, they don't want to – there is an Asian Aryan niche. It's just that they are kind of, I call by definition, new cucks, or they don't want to bring up the message that they are doing these things, right? And they want to be liberals. They want to be race-denying liberals and have fun. You know, it's up to people who are Asian Aryans to basically drop a yellow pill and be like, you have destiny. Your kids are going to be Eurasian. And those Eurasian kids might marry Asian or marry white.
A backup plan is you're saying if the white nationalist goal is for white men to find these young traditional white women and churn out lots of kids and like rebuild Western civilization, you're saying that if that fails, then basically Asian Aryanism is the only hope for saving any kind of civilization.
Exactly. I can see that happening too. But I'm an optimist, and let's suppose there are this white nationalist ethnostate breaks up. As the very first American Renaissance Conference, Richard Spencer has said before that he imagines some ethnostate for whites, like Israel, you know, like a new Israel. You know, we saw
the creation of Israel. Why can't there be both? Why does it have to be one or the other?
Exactly. And so if this white ethnostate is to be envisioned, then I can also assume we could see a black ethnostate, you know, an Asian ethnostate, call it China. But in America context, give the Asian Aryans the size of probably Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where all the Amish are. You know, give them the size of maybe a Delaware, or even smaller, and let them hang out in the Chinatowns of Philadelphia and New York City and the very Asian parts, maybe the San Franciscos of the world. And let Asian Aryanism thrive there. Let Giant Robot, Juxtapose Magazine, Amped Asia Magazine become circulated everywhere. I think this is a culture that needs to be unapologetic and crafty and artsy, and also pick up the anti-liberal thoughts of the alternative right, because this is where the dankness is coming from, the alt-right. And that's why I find many influences from there. I think there's a lot people can learn. We can't just be liberal pussies thinking everything's soft and this and that. No, it's art. Art is for art's sake. We gotta not shock people, but create every possible thought running through us and create freedom, which is also an alt-left position. I see really much a lot of these things happening. And Asian women are great. Also Asian men, too, who date white women. They're also fantastic allies and friends. They have.
Would this be a more kind of an avant-garde society where freedom of artistic expression, or more of a sort of conformist traditional Asian values of Confucianism?
I used to say, if you can imagine a Western Christian Confucius Pan Shinto bastard society, that would probably be an amazing thing to see. Maybe we can have the mentality of Christians, but be Shinto about things, and that would be, you know, we can have like a very clean mom and dad with kids Asian Aryanism. Then we can have the urbanite Asian Aryanism of punk rock shows, art galleries, vegan restaurants, and nerd conventions. We can have that Asian Aryanism, and we can have the Asian Aryanism that is militant and basically creates Asian traditions of Japan, China, and Korea, and have them very militant and accept this. I always have a science fiction scenario about Asian Aryanism where you have four boroughs in this Asian Aryan ethnostate. The first borough is basically the white weebs, the weeb nationalists. It can be white male, white female, and they love Asian society, right? Then we have the second borough, which is the whitewashed Asians, Asian male, Asian female, and they just love white civilization. They want to be white. They love Western civ. They love being around that. The second, third borough is white male, Asian female, Asian male, white female, the interracial mixels. You know, and then the last borough you have is the Eurasian male, Eurasian female, and they're the Eurasian group, like kind of like Kazakhstan, maybe Sabina Alkhatovova. I can never.
So where do the Asian SJWs like Franny Choi fit into this? Are they banished?
No, Franny Choi is a good thing. They can be social justice causes. That's just they're still Asian Aryans, right? And they're going to be social justice Asian Aryans. And funny you mentioned Franny Choi. I have a huge crush on her. I have really weird crushes on girls like that. But imagine all four boroughs dating one another and having friendships and shaking hands and all pledging allegiance to an Asian Aryan identity. And I call this the yellow pilling process. Get all these people and pill them. Show them the yellow pill. Everyone knows this is a truth, like a reality of race. There just has to be this cohesion, this esoteric Freemason clubs called Asian Aryans, and they're into weird stuff like Answer Me magazine by Jim Code and Apocalypse Culture by Adam Parfrey and Feral House and Nine Banded Books and weird stuff like that. Electronic avant-garde music, you name it. And just
even Peter Sotos?
Yeah, yeah, even Peter Sotos. Hey, Lolly, Juju, hey, Mitski, Atari Teenage Riot, you name it. We it's the Asian Aryan artistic avant-dadas grant, and that's we need more of that, and we need more of that strange. I mean, not to sound like Rachel Haywire, but it's an artistic thing as well as a cultural thing too. It's like hipsterdom. I call it. I should rename. I always thought of the thoughts. If I was to make a G-rated version of Asian Aryanism, I would call it hipster Eurasian American. You know.
The other thing is, I mean, it's inevitable that that this whole like Wamafel phenomenon, as you refer to it, is happening on a large scale, and a lot of the numbers of Eurasians are growing, so you're going to have all these people, and you're advocating some kind of a healthy identitarian basis for that, but the other alternative is that you get all these Eurasians in California, and they just grow up, and they become like these kind of rootless cosmopolitans who are basically consumerist, and they lack any true authentic identity. And since basically the growth of that population is inevitable, you're offering an alternative to the latter scenario, which is happening to a significant degree.
Yes, I mean, I'm very critical of myself, and I always say, like, well, what if this talk, Pilleter's talk, is nothing but consuming? Okay, it may be true.
Reminds me about some article. Was it The Right Stuff wrote an article about biracial people and Barack Obama, and it said called them like the gray people, like lacking an identity, like just these kind of rootless individuals.
You mean like mulatto futurism by?
That was the one, mulatto futurism.
Yeah, there's very much overlays of his mulatto. Yeah, they don't have any. Mulatto futurism, media, white liberals, Ashkenazi Jews, they promote this white-black Oreo character, the white-black person, but yet none of that has any basis in reality, and there's no black patriarchy making that happen, so it's an artificially created people. It's the only fascism allowed in this multicultural and diverse people. You could say it's a right-wing thing, and I think compared mulatto futurism to Asian Aryanism, at least Asian Aryanism has a cohesion group of a white patriarchy, Asian women, and Asian patriarchy with white women all working together.
Because look, I mean, Barack Obama was not brought up. He was brought up by a single mom, and his whole life he was like struggling to find this identity, and he was exposed to like Indonesia, his white grandparents, his like a Kenyan father. He had this idealized vision of him, and then he just became like this kind of a rootless cosmopolitan globalist. And that's not something that you want to really go for. But that's not what you're advocating. You're advocating like something, a healthy sense of identity.
Exactly.
And values.
It's funny too because Obama has a half brother, which is married to a Chinese, so they have their Afro-Asian Chinese thing going on. But yeah,
I think his half brother is his mom and with an Indonesian, and so Eurasian.
I got it. But we should avoid go against cosmopolitan. This is the clergy plan in effect. People by natural racial interests go to people like themselves, the shoe allegory, and so people are going to go, whites and Asians are going to flock together because they have high IQ, and there's a lot of sensitive issues against the decadent normie world. Most Asian girls are going to be submissive to their white husbands, and white husbands want that. The geeky STEM types, the science, technology, engineering, math, they want that in their life, and they're going to have a lot of kids with that. And people are going to keep doing that trajectory, going over and over again. And it's not going to support the clergy plan because there's going to be a good patriarchy that basically fights against the materialism of the modern world and the disgusting nature of feminism. It's just that's what Asian Aryanism is really all about. It's not only – it's a collective. It's an interesting type of –
You have this kind of narrative with Asian Aryanism that like white women are all materialistic – and Asian women are all traditional, but I mean, you see the same trends with look at like white women who come from Eastern Europe and Asian women coming from like China or Vietnam or Korea. they come to this country, then the more they assimilate, they adopt our values. So I don't think that it's too simplistic to say, like, white women are all, like, materialistic and Asian women are all traditional. There's plenty of Americanized mm-hmm. Asian women who have exactly. adopted a lot of the bad values of this society.
And I'm being very critical of that. In my book, I'm very critical of several Asian girls I have dated or at least known who were basically slutty like that, basically white girls of Asian skin. And it makes me confused. What is this and that? And how can I be authentic to myself? And yet, why do I have to go and meet these types? It's competition, really. But there's also, I recently wrote for my website an article being very critical, two articles being very critical of the Asian girls I see. One of them was middle-class Martian midget Asian American girls, and the other how Orbital and his Chinese girlfriend got together. I'm very critical of this decadent, you know, womafle class. I'm for the very strong womafle. They can still be friends, right? But they gotta be Asian Aryans. The new cucks are the enemies. And yes, Asian girls can fall to the power of disgusting materialistic culture, but overall I believe in the bell curve, and ultimately they have a soul that can be open and proselytized, you know. Not the I'm trying to say, like, maybe game could work on them more better than a white girl, you know. We could say, you know, shoe allegory, well, you might as well be with people like yourself. But today Western civilization is falling and white birth rates are falling is because there's a tragedy and civil war among white people. But it's really good to have surrogate Asian girls right now because it's a cheating of the system, and we can accept them flaws but be very critical. I mean, I can't stand some of the Asian girls that just don't want to enjoy, you know, being around me for who I am. And I write that a lot in Almanized Babyface, talking about my criticism towards Asian girls as well. In fact, I read a huge rebuttal at the end of the book about how to cure at least Asian Aryanism for white nationalism. How do you stop Asian Aryanism from being effective if this becomes really a thing, right? That's really funny. So if I advocate Asian Aryanism, I'm also saying this resurrection and death, or death and resurrection of Asian Aryanism. Well, here's how Asian Aryanism is inevitable if you guys act a certain way.
Well, the other thing about this is you're advocating an Asian Aryanism that's an equal synergy of whites and Asians, but usually when you have two groups comes together, there's a kind of dichotomy where one group is dominant. So if you have a lot of white men dating and marrying Asian women, then the white men are sexually dominant. But then the other issue is like Chinese economic colonization of the West. You have, like, one example is just like Chinese multimillionaires buying up a lot of property. And you have all these Asian majority cities. You have a lot of them in California and Southern California and the Bay Area and Hawaii. And a lot of them are becoming basically kind of like Chinese colonies. How do you have that healthy synergy? Because usually there's one. Either you get Asian Aryanism where it's a Asian Aryanism with white men and Asian women. So it's an Asian culture where white men are the dominant group. Or you get these, like, Chinese colonies which are emerging, and how do you address those issues?
You know, Greg Johnson said that the solution against Asian Aryanism is amnesty in races. So when people split up and make their ethnostates, right, the first white side is going to be, well, if you're, like, roaming millennial and you're partially Chinese and you associate more with white, there's an amnesty. And so over time, through, say, three generations, your Chinese genes will slightly go away, but still in your blood. The same way, if you're Chinese and you're more white, you're a white Chinese person, well, you might as well go on the Chinese side. And so there's that racial amnesty. However, we're talking about Asian Aryanism, a new group that has an interest in a self-determination for their own values that is both white and Asian. And they don't, you know, they might be people in the group that will come in that might be full alliance towards being Chinese or more white American, yeah, and then they go out of Asian Aryanism, go back, whatever, that, you know, that could happen. There could be an infiltration of an Asian spy, but I don't, would not, there's things I worry about in Asian Aryanism. I hopefully, for one thing, I hope it doesn't become a Chinese spy colony to infiltrate, because that is what the right wing is worried about, is that Asian Aryanism is just a proxy.
I mean, that's already happening. Like, you have these places like in the Silicon Valley and the San Gabriel Valley in Southern California, where where wealthy Chinese are setting up like these birthing hotels so they can come here and get citizenship. So that, I mean, that's a legitimate concern.
Exactly, and in Vancouver, where you have rich, crazy Asian girls, the reality TV show in China, move all the Vancouverian people out, and all these wealthy Chinese girls marry hot white men, and it becomes domination for China. These white men got to take the yellow pill, slap their Chinese wife across the face, and tell them, I'm an Asian Aryan. You're going to suck this white cock and make Asian Aryan babies, okay? I'm not going to be for the Chinese Empire. And that's what is the answer as well. The same with... And so, you know, there are also these claims of we might hear from Tila Tequila, Margaret Cho, or that one Filipina girl, I can't recall her name, that says she doesn't like Asian boys. But, you know, these Asian girls that are more white, they can pass as, you know, white. And you could say the Johnson argument, well, they might as well get amnesty being white. Not exactly, because, one, I think they're Asian Aryanism, and there's a white component to this. How we're going to make Asian
Didn't Craig Johnson say that roaming millennial was dangerously cute?
Yes, and your sweetie. He's your sweetie, honey. He said it like it was his mother, which I found very weird.
Like, not like he was hitting on her.
Yeah, but it sounded like it, like he was his mother. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of weird flirtation there. But what I'm saying is we live in an anti-white culture. And as long as the liberal world has to dump this anti-whiteness, and we got to be pro-white about things. There's nothing wrong with being white or bad about being white. It's white this, white that, white. Well, it's like, one, you're going to be happy being white. And so that's a component to Asian Aryanism, is okay being white as long as okay being Asian. And you have both these two new values. You don't just anti-white and anti-black. This is why there can't be mulatto futurism aesthetically, is because when a white guy has sex with a black girl, the child's going to be black. It's never going to be white. It's always going to be black-skinned. And the Oreo kid's going to be black.
That's an interesting thing you point out, because the people who are, say, biracial, if they're half black, they're automatically identify with black.
Black.
But Eurasians do have this dual identity.
Exactly. They get passed as white. You know, they could... it's just like that Filipina girl who's basically saying she doesn't like white. She likes being Asian and she wants to have white kids and all that fun stuff. And she's selling it on Instagram. She's even like doing a Tila Tequila now and being in front of swastikas to tick off those Hapa idiots. And so it's an interesting subject. Her name, by the way, is Little May Mac. That's it. Little May Mac, and she is a super cutie. I would marry a girl like her, and I think she is definitely an Asian Aryan woman. We need more girls like her, you know. We need more guys to start this, you know, Asian Aryan revolution. In no way this means white genocide or Asian genocide. I do not support white genocide nor Asian genocide. This is a creation of a natural thing of cohesive people that prefer
to... this just a cultural movement identity, or you're actually talking about creating ethnostate or new country?
Well, let's be sci-fi here, and if there was an ethnostate, it would be the size of some Amish tribe. However, there are Eurasian people, and we're really talking about Eurasian nationalism or some Eurasian...
Someone did say, some alt-right guy said, yeah, there is one, it's called Hawaii, you can already go there.
Yeah,
there.
Hawaii is a very beautiful place, and I would probably recommend either Hawaii or San Francisco as an Asian Aryan safe space.
Well, the thing is, those are also... Hawaii and San Francisco are also hubs of the kind of a cultural left. And if you were to go to San Francisco and run for office as an advocate for Asian Aryanism, you would probably be booted out.
I would be a conservative, of course.
Yeah.
I would be like a Japanese or Asian conservative.
The key is change the cultural dichotomy.
Exactly.
I mean, the culture can change.
I look
it's
at
not
it,
set in stone.
Once again, to be PC and correct, I love hipster Eurasian American. I love this ideal of Americanism, where anybody can come in American as a boiling pot and then subscribe to American ideology. I believe in this Asian Aryan Americanism, where you're white, you're a weeb, you're a whitewashed Asian, you're white, well, you can join a part of the colony. Anybody can come into this beautiful Asian Aryan Americanism and subscribe to, you know, big entryism. It doesn't mean one mix to make a super Eurasian race. No, it's always fluctuating and changing. There might be
Is
a Eurasian
this just
block.
For whites and Asians? What if someone was like a black Mexican or Pakistani and they wanted to join?
Well, of course, people like that create maybe the Philippines or Southeast Asians, and of course, there's other subjects like Okinawa and Okinawa, where you had the Somalian soldiers actually rape the Japanese and have these weird dark-skinned Japanese women.
Oh, you were talking about American soldiers.
Yeah, yeah.
American and black soldiers who rape the Japanese
women. They're playing a classical game of gives me that on that. And this is for a serious elite or normal class of people. And I said this before in the black question of Asian Aryanism. They got to do their own thing if they want an Afro-Asian thing. I say good luck to black patriarchy. And let's see if they can do it. But it doesn't look like they can do it because they constantly play gives me that for the white patriarchy to do it for them. So no, this is a private, reclusive area for Eurasians and whites and Asians to have their own little niche going on. It's a unique thing. Why would I want – because once blacks come in, it's clergy plan in effect. I'm just sorry, Tyrone. It's just you don't have any of my interest. Now, I get that there are Asian Aryans that love like black culture – and, you know, trap music and hip-hop stuff. I get it. And there are legitimate reasons for an Asian girl to love and suck black cock. I totally understand. It's a very liberating thing to suck black cock if you're an Asian girl. However, I think there needs to be cohesion. And if we add these, you know, sissy black guys who bitch about, gives me that, and I'm a black man, and I have it hard. And then we're going to go down to this liberal left-wing bullshit monoracial Brazilian culture we were fucking going against. And so, no. There are black Asians who are very worthy, and they have black privilege too. They understand they come from inferior black races, and they want an Asian superior mind to it. The black privilege concept is a very interesting thing that black Asians feel. They feel that they need a side with their Asian side, and they're black because they're afraid that being black is bad enough. It's an interesting concept, but they have their own thing, and Asian Aryans have their other thing.
I'd like to comment on the cover art. It does actually remind me a lot of Trevor Brown. Was that you had this commissioned online, but was that the style you were trying to go for?
You know, the cartoon design is by PM Boons. He is from the Thailands, and I told her up front and said, you know, I really like Trevor Brown, and I really like the torturing of little Japanese girls and sadomasochist stuff like that, and I just thought
that
you
sounds
know
lolly.
Yeah, it seems very lolly too. It's very.
Would lolly be outlawed in your new society?
Some people can practice lolly, but I don't. You know, I don't advocate. I don't advocate pedophilia. I know there's a child porn sickness among the Japanese. No, I'm for hetero stuff. I'm for healthy families. I get the aesthetics, but. You know, I get the aesthetics too, but I'm playing with your mind, and I think Pine Booms did a wonderful job on the album art trying to emulate Trevor Brown, and I think Trevor Brown is an amazing artist and gets ideals across. He himself is an Asian Aryan, a punk, a true hardcore Asian Aryan that belongs in the hall.
Doesn't he live in Japan?
Yeah, he lives in Japan, has a Japanese wife, probably has Japanese kids too, Eurasian, Asian Aryan, Japanese kids as well. Probably beautiful too, thank God he's a father, and I don't know if he does have kids, but, you know, this Trevor Brown art, it's abrasive, it's Asian Aryan, it's punk in attitude, it's in your face, it's a new revelation of thought, it makes you thinking about these things, and it's a whole new kind of punk, and I thought that's a good aesthetic to have, because I know Almond Eyes Babyface is going to be published in limited qualities, and I know it's going to be circulated to several of my friends and other people who will buy it on the internet, and I want to make the cover good and you know, and like a zine, right? And you want people to have that zine. I mean, I got 5 proof copies right now. I'm willing to give out free to some of my friends, but I love that art. It's very cool. It's very interesting, very unique, and I like that. You know, really cool art. And I
you wrote. A vaporwave story in your book about these two characters, Andros and Mayuki, and you talk about the whole vaporwave aesthetic. I think there's even dolphins in it.
Yes, yes. It's I remember you were asking originally for a Vaporwave story about Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, and you were talking about a story about science fiction. I thought, you know what, I'd write a science fiction story about that. And so it is a very abstract, very strange, about Miyuki and Andros, and they are kind of these two sci-fi characters having a loving, futuristic Asian-Aryan relationship of the future that passes for Vaporwave. And so let the whole definitions be suggestive rather than definitive, as I talk about dolphins that fly in your mouth.
Wait, the story is, what's the title of the story?
I don't really have a title for it, but maybe the romance of the future dingy mabob of... I really didn't have any titles working most of these pieces, but I should write titles for them. The only title that really came about was this weird poem I wrote back then called Easy Tiger. I dedicated that to Harriet Sugarcookie because...
Oh, yeah, I remember that from your YouTube video.
I watched a porn video on Pornhub, and I found it amazingly erotic, and I jerked off to it, and I was like, wow, who's this girl? I stalked this girl, I found out she was Harriet Sugarcookie, and I wrote a poem about that. And I don't look at Harriet Sugarcookie videos again, but that video, sucking white cock and her cute little tiger thing, that's adorable, right? And so I wrote something about that. And it's just powerful women like Harriet Sugarcookie are true Asian-Aryan Valkyrie women that belong in the halls of Xanadu. They are the women of the Red Sun.
For the aesthetic of this society, do you envision... Well, there's different ones. I mean, there's the kind of... queer aesthetic of like a Padaliro. There's the cyberpunk aesthetic of Kira. Then there's the sort of more aristocratic aesthetic of Katsue Tokina Uta. And then there's like Vaporwave. Do you envision one of those, or would it just be like this kind of upper middle class suburban society?
You know, that is one. That upper middle class suburban is one that I see in reality. You know, my neighbors are Asian. Or Eurasian. The other neighbors are Asian. I see the cute little Eurasian girls get off the bus with their white husbands and cute Chinese moms. I see that all the time. But for, let's say, for future sake, if you can imagine Amano, the Yoshiko Amano of Final Fantasy, if you can imagine that being a reality, you know, if you can imagine these strange... you know, Shiko Amano stuff, or you know, Final Fantasy characters of high aristocratic Asian European features of super, not HR Giger buildings, but something new that sounds like an out there society that's, you know, cute and Asian and good and healthy. And
well, Final Fantasy is like a Japanese take on the kind of like medieval Europe.
Yeah, yeah, that is one. You know, I've been looking at the art of Amano Yoshitaka a lot, and I find a lot of.
So it could be there. Maybe it could be like a theme. Could be like a theme park, kind of like Disneyland. Like you'd have a Kira cyberpunk district, Katsue exactly. Tokina Uta district with like the aristocratic thing, a Padaliro like queer district,
and Amano aesthetically pleasing the Book of the New Sun Amano stuff. You know.
Really, and then maybe just one area that would just be like boring bumfuck suburbia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not that's a little harsh, bumfuck, but cute. You know, if they enjoy themselves there, and basically like, you know, yeah, there's all these aesthetics of Asian-Aryanism going on, and it's all noir.
Well, it's like what you said. Make anime real. Like, yeah, all these people. Have these fans. It's kind of like the popularity of like theme parks and places like Disneyland and Las Vegas. People go to these places for a sense of escapism from their mundane lives, but no one actually talks about building societies based on their fantasies.
I mean, there's even a restaurant that my one friend Jotaro showed me called the White Man Restaurant in Japan. Where basically, it's the White Man Cafe, and basically what you do is you go there, and you're Japanese, and you experience Western civilization and white people and being white. And
So you see Japan, I mean, Japan is closer to your ideas of Asian Aryanism than China. Make the case maybe a country, I mean, a country like Singapore, possibly, because they have that strong, like, British influence.
Yeah, and some of the Japanese are basically, you know, this white man cafe. It's strong and powerful, and they got white-speaking Japanese. It's the aesthetic they're living in, this powerful thing. And so it's very interesting and very of a and it's cute too, because some of these Japanese really enjoy the aesthetics of white men coming to their aid, and it just shows you there is that Asian Aryan bond right there. And I don't know, I just think it's a wonderful thing, really. I think
you wrote this story, so you have a new edition of your novel Trip. You added this book called, it's a science fiction erotic novella called The Rape of McCall. I actually think you should have put it out as a separate novel, but it works as an addition to Trip. Basically, it's set in the future, and there's these two races. They're are like the Saparians, who are these are they like kind of like Nazi Vikings? And yeah. Then you have these like a green skin, white haired Medoras.
Yeah, Medore.
They look like cats, kind of like
they're like sexy cat girls, anime cat girls.
So are these supposed to be aliens, or like the distant descendants of humans?
They're like the distant descendants of the Japanese, and the Saparians are the distant descendants of super alt-right envision ethno-state Viking warriors. And this one Saparian comes to the planet of Moa, going on a rampaging rage, massacring the town, and sees a really sexy Midori girl, and he fucks her in the ass and has sex with her mason green ass, and I just have fun with the sex. I was even jerking off to my work, and just having fun with it, and just making like porn slash erotic fiction slash shock art slash funny stuff, but also a fun Asian Aryan message along with it. I made sure that the main girl, Zia, you know, the daughter has, you know, she has a nice pair of peach titties, you know, good at tick fucking, only prefers Saparian guys. You know, it sounds like a very sexy science fiction way. I play fun at everything.
Is it lighthearted, or there's some dark aspects to it too? Like she's taken and forced into prostitution.
Yeah,
it's a combination of both.
Yeah, there's that, and there are dark scenes and wisdoms about race, and as well lighthearted scenes of finding your dad and mom, and basically being a proud woman, of being a good prostitute and working the bar and make sure you only prefer a certain amount of guys, and punk culture and tats, and you're getting all this all at once. It's a very quick book. It's a really quick story, and it's just a lot of stuff is going on, and I play off a lot of fun words, and I really the outcome of it.
I haven't seen the movie, and I forget the name off the top of my head, but wasn't there that science fiction film which people on the alt-right were saying was like liberal propaganda, where humans discover this planet in outer space, and there's like this
Avatar.
Avatar. I was kind of thinking it's a little bit like that, but like pornographic.
Yeah, but it's like you have sex with these alien girls, and you dominate them, and you make a brand new race out of Saparian Midori, and they belong together. And I also make messages about being the Midori, being you know, better than normal Saparian women. And basically saying there's this connection, right? Why did they rape and pillage the planet, you know? They belong to this greater scheme, and the Saparian, a new human race cult, will be formed out of the Saparians.
Oh, so there's a new race that's created as the offsprings.
Yes, as the Saparians and the Midori, and it's about that adventure towards that and the connection. And it makes ultimately a subtle Asian Aryan message. And so I thought it'd be really cool to add the story to Trip and extend upon it, and I think it's a very good addition. I think it's interesting. I could have made it longer, but I think it's very short, very quick, and it's a really funny, there's funny scenes in it, very interesting. If you like classic science fiction, and as well as sex stuff, you might jerk off to it. I don't know, but I hope you jerk off to it and learn a moral lesson about Asian Aryanism. So yeah.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Pilator, is there anything else you'd like to add about Almond Eyes, Baby Face, or any of these other topics?
I think Almond Eyes, Baby Face is a very personal work. There's a lot of stories in this. It is a document of 60,000 words, and a lot. I cover everything from personal memoirs to science fiction stories to cut and paste to basically wisdom about this question that is facing the alt-right about Asian girls. You know, if you like Asian girls but you're afraid to like one, well, this book is your answer, and this will be a artistic expression, a portrait of a young Asian Aryan for you to be open about these things. It's kind of a manifesto in its own thing. It is the Asian Aryan Manifesto, Almond Eyes Babyface, and I strongly suggest you go to Lulu and actually support and buy a copy. Along with Trip, too. Trip is a great novella, and as well, check that out with Raven McCall.
Pillater, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you very much, Robert. It's always nice talking to you, like always.